So my name is José Bové. Listen to health writers if you are concerned about the health of the body politic.
Good evening and welcome to Health Writers. I'm your host, Mary Moyer. In tonight's program, we continue our examination of the Affordable Care Act and the recent Supreme Court decision regarding the act. Earlier this week, I spoke with Robert Craig, the Executive Director of Citizen Action Wisconsin, and Matthew Rothschild, the editor and publisher of the Progressive magazine, to get their perspectives on the topic. In our conversations, we discuss key features of the Affordable Care Act, what happened in the Supreme Court decision, the implications for BadgerCare, and the pros and cons of the law in terms of reaching a universal publicly funded healthcare system in this country. First, we go to Robert Craig, followed by Matt Rothschild. We're here talking with Robert Craig from Citizen Action Wisconsin. He's the executive director there. And we're just going to talk a little bit about the Affordable Care Act, the Supreme Court decision that came down in June, and what that means. Welcome, Robert.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
First, I think I want to talk about background and how the Affordable Care Act got to the Supreme Court.
Well, it took 98 years for our country from the first president to advocate for national health care, Theodore Roosevelt, to actually passing it under President Obama. And that was not the, as we said at the time in 2010, that was not the end of the debate by any means, even though it took six overtimes to pass it through Congress. There was an amazingly scary process in many ways. Dismayed a lot of people. But then opponents went all out to try to get it overturned in the Supreme Court. And originally, most legal scholars, even conservative legal scholars, thought it was a near frivolous lawsuit, that the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution clearly allowed regulation of 18% of the economy, like health care. But it actually, partly because of the very effective campaign by the insurance industry and by conservatives, came very close to being overturned. In fact, a lot of pundits thought it was going to at least partially be overturned, at least the individual mandate being struck down. But Justice Roberts blinked and switched his vote. And so he upheld it on the power of the federal government to tax based on the 16th Amendment. And so the law was upheld for the most part, though they did open up a loophole that allows states to turn down the extra money for Medicaid. And states that do that, that could have devastating consequences for a lot of low-income people who would otherwise be covered. But the law itself is moving forward, and this sets up a huge transformation of the American healthcare system. Really the most, it's not a revolution, but it's a major evolution.
Talk about what the key features of the act are and which pieces were upheld and which were not.
Now, the idea of the Affordable Care Act was, in fact, it adopted a number of formerly Republican ideas, like an individual mandate requiring everyone to buy insurance, but also making it affordable for those people and outlawing discrimination so that people who have pre-existing conditions have a right to buy coverage and can't be charged more. I mean, these are fundamental features, but a lot of it was implemented over time, starting 6 months in 2010. Full implementation of the biggest features is in 2014, which is why we've been in a situation where a lot of it still wouldn't have happened if it was overturned by the Supreme Court or if it's overturned by Congress before full implementation. But the basic idea is to try to guarantee that everyone has as much as possible control of their own healthcare decisions, so decisions are made by patients and medical providers, and that there's basic health security, that everyone has some place to go to buy affordable healthcare, no matter what their situation or what their job situation, whatever walk of life. And so to do that, what it tried to do is to leave the current part of our system in place that's still working, which is insurance at larger companies, at the government, for example, if you work for state government or local government, where it doesn't work. People who work for small businesses, only a third of Wisconsin small businesses now provide coverage, great reduction. People who buy insurance on their own, like consultants, like people like farmers who don't have an employer, or uninsured people have some place to go. And it creates, by 2014, two major ways to do that. It expands Medicaid, what we call BadgerCare. to cover everyone over under a certain income level. Now, right now, it covers various categories of people. It's very complicated. Yeah. So it's sort of a patchwork quilt. Whereas Badger Care in Wisconsin, Medicaid nationally, will cover everyone under a certain income level. Then for still lower income and middle income people above that Medicaid line, there'll be regulated private health insurance, where they outlaw the worst discrimination, where insurance companies have to provide coverage, where they can't charge higher rates if people have health conditions, where they can't charge women higher rates. Right now, there's terrible gender discrimination. Women pay a lot more in Wisconsin, for example. And where there are requirements as to what that insurance has to cover, which are decided by panels of experts and doctors, not by the insurance industry. People can go to it. It's like travel. It'll be like Travelocity. Choose which insurance provider they want, which health plan they want. There'll be four basic health plans. And then on top of that, in terms of it being regulated competition, there are tax subsidies to help afford it, way up into the middle class, up to four times the federal poverty level, which is about $93,000 a year for a family of four. People up to that level will get tax subsidies. The trade-off is, in order to make this work financially, people have to buy insurance. We can't have people waiting till they're sick to buy insurance, or it would become much too costly. And people need to pay into the system in order to make it effective. And the argument of most legal scholars of the Obama administration was that this is 18% of the economy. The only way to make the health insurance market work is for everyone to participate in it. And so, therefore, it was crucial to regulation of interstate commerce. Justice Roberts, the swing vote, the Chief Justice, didn't actually uphold it on the Commerce Clause, which surprised everyone, but upheld it on the taxing power under the 16th Amendment, and therefore saw the fine for not buying insurance as a tax. So that's how we ended up with it being upheld. They did, as I said, though, there was a part of the case that people thought was far less likely to happen was that the Medicaid expansion was somehow unconstitutional. That's the part for low-income people. They did not determine it was unconstitutional, but they determined that the federal government could not withhold Medicaid money from the states in order to force them to accept the expansion money. And so that has opened up a loophole where states could turn down the new money. It would make no sense unless you're just trying to destroy the law, which is the motive of some governors, like, unfortunately, Governor Walker. For a state like Wisconsin, the state, if it turned down the money, it would cost it $3 billion between now and 2019. So it would actually lose money and fewer people would be covered if it turned it down. But about three or four governors have said they'll turn down the money. We'll see if they go through with it. And Governor Walker is being coy, but has said he's not made a decision yet whether to accept the expanded money for Medicaid. The danger then would be you could have a group of low-income people who have too much money in order to qualify for Badger Care, but still make too little to be able to afford insurance on the new competitive health marketplace.
Criticism from the left points out that private insurance and pharmaceutical companies are still involved with access to health care through the Affordable Care Act. What's your thought on that and how this act leads or doesn't lead to a universal health care system?
I mean, I think that that's a well-grounded statement. This is why it's not what the right says. It's not socialized medicine like we have in Great Britain. It's not a government takeover. You still have the pharmaceutical industry and you have the health insurance industry gets a huge amount of new business out of this plan, which raises the question as to why they're trying to undermine something. Partly because they're committed to a business model that allows them to choose only healthy customers and to profit off of that. There aren't people in other advanced industrial countries that would want a system like we have. We would never have built a system if we were planning it the way we have it. Really, the Affordable Care Act is a major intervention, major surgery of the system, but it didn't replace the whole system. And so we're stuck in this much more complicated position of trying to evolve a system while keeping it in some way and grafting other new things on top of it, giving it some artificial limbs, etc. It's much harder than just starting from scratch, but it would be politically impossible in this country just to wipe away 80% of the economy and build a whole new system from scratch. You had to deal with the politics of the country as they stand in the early 21st century, and you have to deal with the fact that we allowed to grow up since World War II piecemeal a private health insurance system and private pharmaceutical system that has immense political power. I think that therefore this was the most we could have gotten. We might have gotten a public option, which we strongly supported, and we think President Obama should have held on to the public option. But he got 95% of what he possibly could have gotten given the political conditions of 2010. In fact, they've gotten worse since 2010. It allows us to test how far we can go with a regulated private system and to try to make it work. And if it doesn't work, or if we don't get all that we need out of it, because we need to control health care costs, or they're unaffordable if we don't do it. The Republican solution is to shift costs onto seniors, shift costs onto states. That'll just make the matters worse. That's what Paul Ryan's proposals do.
With the Affordable Care Act, fairly high costs remain for individuals to purchase insurance and pharmaceuticals. How is this increasing access to health care?
I do think it puts us in a situation that we can add a public option, that we can move it more and more to a more universal national health care system. It's a question of how we get there. We didn't have a strong enough movement to force that in this political system. In fact, pharma, that's the lobbying arm of the pharmaceutical industry, was so strong that it was able to say to Obama and his people quietly, we have $250 million in a war chest, and we'll spend it all to destroy the Affordable Care Act unless you give us what you want. And then they cut the deal. That's the way business has gone in Washington, which tells you we really need to change our campaign finance system as part of getting universal access to health care. It's amazing how far we got. One of the problems is that a lot of the cost-saving measures that would change the payment system, that would allow the federal government to use its power to negotiate, say, with the pharmaceutical industry, was all reduced to pilot programs. We need to actually change the way we do health care in this society and focus on preventive care, chronic disease management, wellness, rather than waiting to have heroic intervention after people are sick. The Affordable Care Act creates mechanisms that could do that. Mm. What's going to happen, though, is that there's going to be resistance from the healthcare industry every step of the way. So we need to engage citizens in a real movement in order to make the Affordable Care Act as strong as it could be. And then once we get to that point, take it to further steps in order to rationalize this system. So you're absolutely right. It's still going to be more expensive than the other system in the world. For the first time, there's going to be a backstop. In other words, no matter what happens to you at work, there'll be a place for you to go to buy health insurance. And the health insurance industry will not be able to say no or charge you discriminatory rates. But the rates will still be too high. And we need to focus on that issue because the right wing's plan is to shift more costs on everyone else. That's what Ryan's Medicare plan is. It's what Paul Ryan's Medicaid plan is, which has passed the House of Representatives as their budget 2 years in a row. It's also what the whole idea of going to very high deductible plans with health savings accounts is about. It's about shifting costs onto people which they already can't afford. So it is a huge step forward, but it's not the end of the fight by any stretch of the imagination.
Key elements of the Affordable Care Act were originally right-wing ideas, which Obama presumably included to win some Republican support. However, that was a strategy that failed. I'm wondering why the Democrats didn't create the bill that they should have in the first place.
It's a great point. It does, you know, really put up a warning sign about negotiating with yourself. That is to say, they didn't get any more Republican votes by doing this, because they get no Republican votes, okay? But what happened behind the scenes was that for the first time in the history of the healthcare debate, every major industry player except for the insurance companies supported this. So the AMA, which has destroyed healthcare reform for years, supported it, the American Medical Association. Pharma, the pharmaceutical lobby, supported it, right? The hospitals, the American Hospital Association, supported it. And if they had gone much further, they would have lost that support, and those people could have spent millions and millions of dollars to prevent them from passing anything. I think that they could have done a lot more to make sure that there was a strong public option in there that held private industry more accountable and gave people another kind of choice, kind of a Medicare program competing directly with private health insurance. Ted Caddy would have, but he was sick. So that's one of those historical accidents. Ted Caddy had been healthy another year, maybe didn't have a different health care bill, but Max Baucus was doing it, and he was a very problematic figure. In addition, I don't think President Obama, particularly early in his administration, he did not see the stakes in that enough and thought that if he could get a deal that had most of the features, that was fine. I think given that the public option was popular, that he could have held it. It could have been passed through reconciliation. In fact, a majority of Democratic senators had already supported it before, so that we could have gotten that, and that would have gotten us further ahead. So I would say this health care law could have been, you know, 20% better than it was at most. That might be an overestimation, but it was still most of what could have been gotten in this situation. The question is, what do we do with it?
Can you talk a little bit about the implications for Badger Care?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that the court, surprisingly, while upholding the individual mandate, the Supreme Court said that states didn't have to accept the Medicaid expansion money, even though it's crazy because the federal government pays for the whole thing for the first 3 years and pays much more than they pay for Medicaid moving forward. It's a great deal for the states financially. There's another piece to that. That is, a lot of governors wanted to cut Medicaid more, Badger Care in Wisconsin, during the last budgets because they were so tight because the federal government pulled back on the stimulus money. And the Affordable Care Act didn't allow them to do that. It had what's called a maintenance of effort requirement, which said they had to keep doing what they were doing on Medicaid in a lot of circumstances, especially when you're covering kids. Walker tried to make changes that would have forced 65,000 people off Medicaid. He was only able to do changes that would force 17,000 people off Badger Care. So there are two elements. First, the Walker administration, his health services secretary, Dennis Smith, are saying that they think the Supreme Court decision means they can throw another 48,000 people off Badger Care, make changes to force them off. Federal government disagrees. So that's going to be a major tension point between the Walker administration and the Obama administration. That's one thing. Second thing is that the governor is toying with the idea of turning down the Medicaid expansion. He was so strongly against Obamacare, as he calls it, and it took such a strong stand before and after the Supreme Court decision saying he would not implement it, even though it had been upheld until after the presidential election, that a lot of national people assumed that he was turning down the Medicaid money. They've now clarified that they've not decided. I think that's because hospitals, insurance companies, others were quietly saying, maybe you should take that money. That's a lot of money, and it's going to be really hard on hospitals and doctors and providers if we don't have that money. So I think pressure could be brought to bear on him to not take that step, though he is certainly acting like he may take that step because it seems his political read is that he becomes a national figure if he positions himself as one of the chief nullifiers of national health care reform. He wants to run at the national level with Tea Party folks around the country. In addition, he did turn down the high-speed train money, so he's shown the willingness to really harm the state in order to take this sort of ideological stand.
And the federal reimbursement, the potential federal reimbursement is 95% and then drops to...
It starts out 100%.
Okay.
Then it's 95%, and then ends up at 90% of the cost of the expansion is paid for by the federal government. Right now, Medicaid is paid for 60%. The other thing that happens, which saves the state money, is that some people who are in Badger Care now end up in the health insurance exchange, and then they get paid for entirely by the federal government. So it acts actually going to reduce the amount of Badger Care spending on current recipients as well. It's an incredibly good financial deal for the state. The only way you turn down this money is if you literally put your own reputation on the far right above the lives of people.
What's your read on public opinion and what Americans think about affordable health care?
It's always been this conundrum since passage. The provisions, if you poll the provisions of the law independently, they're popular. The brand itself, deemed Obamacare, has been unpopular because people don't know that those provisions that are popular are in it. And the other side has gone out of its way to misinform the public, and they spent $200 million since passage to do television ads in order to mislead people on what's in the law. Certainly the 30% of the electorate that's very conservative, Tea Party, is adamantly opposed, sees it as socialism. Then you have, on the Democratic side, you actually have some part of Democratic campaign, the more progressive part, that's been concerned that it's not Medicare for all. And so some of the opposition is it doesn't go far enough on our side, right? And then you have this independent group that doesn't know what to think. But the more they find out about it, the better. And so time is our ally, and getting used to it is our ally.
Well, thank you, Robert, for joining us and talking about the Affordable Care Act.
Thank you very much for having me.
We're joined now by Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive magazine, to continue our discussion about the Affordable Care Act. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, Mary. Thanks for having me on. I love being on WORT, and it's nice to be on your show.
Great. Well, in June, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. Is this a small victory towards achieving a universal health care system, or is it problematic?
Well, it's problematic, not so much what the Supreme Court decided, but what Obama decided not to do early on, which was not to go for single payer, not even to go for a public option. Obama treated the progressive movement that helped elect him as chumps and just used us as a foil, saying, well, I could be for universal health care, but I'm not going that far out on a limb, or I could offer a public option, and he dangled it a little bit and then just threw us overboard with it and settled for this half measure here. It's a half measure, however, that he would be unable to do better than right now because, of course, the House of Representatives is now in Republican hands. He had an opportunity early in his administration when he had the House and the Senate and a 75% approval rating really to push for universal single payer, at least a public option, a decent public option, what I call Medicare for all who want it. And as a result, he didn't do that. And as a consequence, we have this private health care still firmly entrenched here in the United States. And as a result, while there are real benefits in the Affordable Care Act, what remains in place is the private insurance industries that have no limit on the raises they can impose on us for premiums. And I believe those premiums are just going to go through the roof now.
And, you know, you brought up the Medicare for All bill. Now that the Affordable Care Act has been upheld, what do you think about this Conyers bill as a viable alternative? I mean, can this can we go further?
Well, we can go further. I don't think the Conyers bill is going to go further. We can't go further in D.C. right now because of the House being in Republican hands, and it's likely to stay in Republican hands after the election. We can go further state by state, and I think that's where the hope lies, really in doing the local and statewide organizing around the country for universal single payer. It's happening in Vermont, and it's happening. There are movements in other states to get this to happen, and I think that's how we're going to have to push this country forward one state at a time, the way the progressive movement did it earlier in the 20th century. But as far as on the national level, given that Obama abdicated early on in his administration when he had the power to bring about, if not single payer, at least Medicare for all who want it, at this point I think it was a plus, certainly on balance, that the U.S. Supreme Court decided to uphold the Affordable Care Act. It was a surprising plus, and that John Roberts, the Chief Justice, was the decisive vote, and he's an arch-conservative and was supposed to be, you know, securely in the Scalia camp, but it was a surprise that way. The best part about it is that people who have pre-existing conditions cannot be discriminated against. That was one of the most immoral things about our current healthcare system, and to see that go the wayside is a great thing and definitely a step forward.
Do you think that the best strategy in achieving universal healthcare here would be to accept these smaller piecemeal changes within the current framework, or do we accept nothing less than wholesale and more significant changes?
Well, I think we have to
somewhere in between.
Yeah, I'm kind of in between. I think we have to push for more significant changes. We have to push for the change that we want, the change that we know is the most moral and decent and humane, which is a single payer and universal coverage for all, and to get the private insurance companies out of the business of gouging American consumers from the rights that are basic to humanity and enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the right to health care. Still, I think we need to recognize that if the Supreme Court had ruled the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional, it's not like we would have had single-payer health care the next day. It's not like John Boehner in the House of Representatives would have said, okay, let's go for single payer, let's push for universal health care, let's go for Medicare for all who want it. No, they would have kept the system as it is, and that is such an immoral system. It's such a cruel system that leaves so many millions and tens of millions of people without health care insurance and discriminates against those who have pre-existing conditions or those who have reach their lifetime limits on their health insurance plans. That's just kind of savage, barbaric capitalism. And this at least is a half step away from that. It's insufficient. It won't solve the problem of the health care costs in this country because the private insurance companies will continue to raise costs dramatically. And at some point, people will decide not to sign up for health care and just take the penalty. And if they're taking the penalty, the tax, several hundred dollars a year, and then they're going to the emergency room for emergency care, that's what drives the ultimate cost through the roof, and that won't be good for the system as a whole. So it's certainly not an adequate solution to the crisis of healthcare in America, but it does get at some of the most egregious problems we have right now.
You mentioned the Universal Declaration of Human Rights that enshrines healthcare as a right. What do you think it will take for Americans to move to that mindset and thinking of healthcare as a right instead of as a business proposition or a way to make money?
Well, it's a real serious question. I mean, what will it take for Americans to stand up and fight for their rights generally? I mean, we saw a little bit of it with the Occupy movement. We saw a lot of it here in Wisconsin with the uprising against Scott Walker, which was so dramatic and exhilarating. But, you know, Americans just sit back and take it and take it and take it. And it's just to an extraordinary degree. I mean, look what happened after, you know, Bush stole the election from Gore. I mean, if we were in Mexico, we'd have been in the streets for 6 months. That's what they did there when they had elections stolen from them. And when people's rights are continually taken away, I mean, I've been surprised that there hasn't been a mass movement of the 5 million people whose homes have been foreclosed upon. So it's really an open question as to how much people can take before they really get into the streets. And I keep being surprised by the willingness or capability of people just to take more and more and suffer through it.
Doesn't the mandate to purchase health insurance amount to a regressive tax on working people?
Yeah, and the people whose taxes are going to be raised are not, you know, the wealthy. They've got insurance. They've got great insurance. They got Cadillac insurance, so they're going to continue to have their insurance plans, and they won't be penalized by not having insurance. So the people who are likely to say, well, I can't afford to pay the cost of these premiums that keep going up and up are the people who are already poor or right on the bubble of being poor. And so you're right, it is a regressive tax, and it is a huge benefit to the insurance companies. I mean, the insurance companies were put in a position here where if the Supreme Court rejects the Affordable Care Act, they win. And if it approves the Affordable Care Act, they win because they get 30 million more customers. And also system-wide, the system suffers on the cost level because there's no ceiling on the premiums that they can impose, and then on the emergency care that people are going to have to run to if they decide they're not going to get insurance because they can't afford it and they'll pay the hundreds of dollars in tax penalties as a result. Well, that's bad as far as the macro costs on the entire system and ultimately on the taxpayers. So the taxpayers are going to have to cover it at some point, and rather than have us cover it on the front end with a progressive tax on the richest people in this country, we're going to cover it on the back end, and we're covering it all the way through with poor people having to pay the freight. And that's a ridiculous way to structure the system.
And turning to the implications for BadgerCare in Wisconsin, do you think that Governor Walker would jeopardize access to health care for thousands of Wisconsinites and turn back the federal money for the Medicaid expansion?
I do believe he'll follow in Rick Perry's footsteps down in Texas. I mean, I think it's outrageous that Republican governors are going to turn down Medicaid funding, federal funding at 100% for the first few years that would pay for people, adults, at 133% of the poverty line or below. Yep. These people could now get Medicaid, which they deserve. I mean, we all deserve to have Medicare or Medicaid funding. And for the longest time, single adult men in the United States have been excluded from it at whatever level. And so this imposes a level above the poverty line, which is nice, 133%. And the federal government would pay for it for several years and then ultimately pay 90% of it. So why states won't go along with that, especially in the short term when they don't have to pay a single penny for it, is beyond me and beyond callous. But you see Scott Walker and Perry and these other right-wing Republican governors who would rather wave the Tea Party flag and deny people their rights and make people suffer than give people what they rightly deserve.
Well, thank you, Matt, for joining us and sharing your thoughts.
It's my pleasure.
That concludes our program for tonight. Thanks for joining us. And thank you to our guests, Matt and Robert, for their insights. Also, thank you to Steve Blank, fellow health writer, in helping to produce the show.